This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I called this lecture A New Language of Justice, and then there's stuff after the colon because I'm an academic, right? But really because we're in a moment where people are shocked into a space that they don't know how to make sense out of. Right. And so my goal today is to try and help us a little bit with that. And I need to give you a little bit of background about how I've been trying to do that in my life and in my work for the better part of the last decade. So in the lovely introduction you heard, I'm the president of the Center for Policing Equity. That's a research and action think tank that looks at issues of racial and gender equity within policing. And we don't just look at them. We try and make them better. And I want to start for some context with a couple of humanizing elements, some anecdotes of things that we got a chance to go through. About 10 years ago, as I do, we got asked to come and visit a police department in the Midwest of the United States. And while we were there, there was a chief who said, "Dr. Goff, I really want to say, I'm glad you're here, because the racial profiling stats of the county are terrible. We're the city, we're better. But I don't know what that means." That could mean that the county is terrible and we're terrible. It could mean that we're great and the county's great, just not as great as we are, which I totally knew. Or it could mean that we're great and they're terrible or anything in between. I don't know what any of the stats mean. But I'll tell you one thing I do know. I do know that we are one dead black teenager from this whole city burning to the ground. And here's the worst part about that. Not only did I not tell you what city I was in, there's no way for you to tell. Because I could be almost anywhere in the United States. And I'm going to be talking to you about data, because data is part of my passion. I'm going to be talking to you about experiments and all those kinds of sciencey things, and we can talk about internal validity, and I can talk about the ways in which I've gone about this methodologically. But I also want to make sure that this is rooted in the lives of the people and the families of the people who've been touched by the reason why anybody's paying attention to this topic at all. Right? It's important to know, right, that we were in New York doing research when Eric Garner was put into a chokehold and died. We worked with BART, which an officer shot and killed Oscar Grant. We worked in Florida, where Trayvon Martin was killed. Chicago with Rekia Boyd, Terica Wilson, with Yvette Smith, 93-year-old Pearly Golden, who was shot and killed in her own home because they got the wrong home. And of course, we were in Ferguson and St. Louis doing research on the day that Michael Brown Jr. was killed. It's important to know that these aren't just pictures, they're not just media, these are human beings who had families, as are the officers who were involved in their killings. It's important to know it and to center it on humanity because we're all living very different kinds of lives. If we're in this room, we get to live, we have the privilege of living different kinds of lives, but it's affecting us as human beings. We're connected to it. So I like, before I get deep into the rest of the theory and the science, I like to call out the names of the places where we've been and the people who've been there with us. So all of this is happening in a context, race and policing, that I probably don't need to say, bless you. I probably don't need to say, you may know there's absolutely no national level data, right? That's kept at least by the federal government on what police officers do. We know about crime, but we don't know how many people get pulled over, and we sure as heck don't know how many people are shot and killed by police every year. The best thing we have is an estimate, and it's frankly not that great of an estimate, from newspapers aggregating it. Right? The Washington Post and The Guardian know more than the FBI does on this. But more importantly than that, we come to this moment of understanding race and policing with an understanding of racism that's fundamentally insufficient. It does not capture the lived realities of race in America. And we were not ready for what happened in this election cycle. Right? No matter who you voted for, no one was ready. I know, having spoken to the transition team, the Trump team was not ready. I can tell you from talking to the Hillary team, Hillary was not ready. I can absolutely tell you that everybody across the country thought we were going to be in a slightly different, if not a radically different world than we are now. And everything that came in the election cycle and everything that's coming since, we've not been fully prepared for it, particularly when it comes to issues of race. So what I want to do today with that context, I want to make the argument that there's a need for new language to make sense of where we've been, not just during the election cycle, but over the course of the last 2 years, since Ferguson. I'm going to supply a draft of that language, if you will, right, to develop the science of the problem. I'm going to proffer at the end the possibility that research can be part, I hope, of the solution to all of that. I'm going to do that in the following sections. We're going to talk about identity traps. That's that new language. I talk about two different kinds, fast traps and slow traps. Then I'm going to look at how research has been a lever on policy and policing, some of the stuff we've done. And then I'm going to stop talking for a little bit, and you guys are going to talk and ask me questions, I hope. Does that make sense as an outline? Yeah, everybody there with me? Yes? Okay. And one amen. I appreciate it. All right. So from the beginning of the time that I thought that research was a cool thing to do, I've always started with one question. And the question is, what causes discrimination? So think about that for a little bit. What causes discrimination? If you have to close your eyes, right, imagine it, what do most people say? What causes discrimination in most people's minds is bad people. Okay? And the color of this devil changes depending on what you're talking about, but it's mostly just bad people. Bad thoughts, bad hearts. That's why we talk about hate crimes and fighting ignorance. Okay? Problem is, this doesn't really fit the data. And here's what I mean. Things have really changed. This is from a series of studies of whites' endorsements of anti-black stereotypes. They call it the Princeton Trilogy. I'm a Harvard guy. I assume they call it the Princeton Trilogy because at Princeton they don't teach you to count past three. I don't know. It's clearly five time courses. But what you see from 1933 to 2000 is it gets better. It's kind of uncontroversial, right? You might learn that superstition is more than a Stevie Wonder song, but it gets better. This is not just learning the right things to say. This isn't political correctness throughout the era. That can't account for this. It gets better. And then we elected a black president and racism was over, right? Right. No. Because the more things change, of course, the more they stay the same. This is now not endorsement of stereotypes. This is inequality. What I'm showing you here are black-white inequality expressed as a ratio. And what that means is if a black child was as likely to die in infancy as a white child, we'd see the bars hovering right here at the white line of one. And not only are the bars above one, they're going up over time for infant mortality, unemployment, poverty. I can do this for educational achievement and a whole host of other important public sector accomplishments. So what the heck is going on? How do we make sense of declining prejudice in the presence of persistent or increasing inequality? And see, here's the thing. If you imagine that the reason why we have racial inequality is because of racist people, this is a conundrum. That's what I mean by it doesn't fit the data. And this was a much easier talk to give before 2016. Because when I started giving this talk during the election cycle, people would say, yeah, prejudice, it really hasn't gone away. Prejudice is making a comeback. In fact, many people quoted LL Cool J and said, don't call it a comeback. It's been here for years. 2016 seems like it might be inconsistent. Seems like prejudice is not so much in decline anymore. I'd like to argue that, in fact, it is consistent with this same trend, right? Because if racism is about intentions, racism is divorced from outcomes, right? It's all about how I feel about you. And if I don't feel negative things about you, whatever I say can't be racism. If I ask you how you would measure racism, what you want to do, you want to ask people questions about how they feel. So if I take that away and it's divorced from outcomes, then what if I say something racist, but I don't mean it? Or I say something racist and I say, but I'm not racist. Some of my best friends are, right? Doesn't that get me off the hook, right? So what's at stake in 2016 is not a fundamental change in this dynamic. It's the need to change the theory because there is a retreat from defining the norms of justice such that expressions of racism have to count for something because of their consequences. Okay? Now, all of that I hope makes a little bit of sense. It will never make as much sense, nor will it have as funky of a backbeat to it as my friend Jay Smooth. So let me explain this to you, or allow him to explain this to you a little bit more clearly. This is Jay Smooth, who runs the oldest hip-hop show on radio in America, Hip Hop Underground, right? The Digital Underground, explaining how to talk about racism. He does a better job than I do. And with any luck, the tech will work. And we're good, by the way, here.
Race. The Final Frontier. No matter what channel you watch, no matter what feed you aggregate, it seems like everybody everywhere is talking about race right now. And when everybody everywhere is talking about race, that means sooner or later you're gonna have to tell somebody that they said something that sounded racist. So you need to be ready and have a plan in place for how to approach the inevitable "that sounded racist" conversation. And I'm going to tell you how to do that. The most important thing that you've got to do is remember the difference between the "what they did" conversation and the "what they are" conversation. Those are two totally different conversations, and you need to make sure that you pick the right one. The "what they did" conversation focuses strictly on the person's words and actions and explaining why what they did and what they said was unacceptable. This is also known as the "that thing you said was racist" conversation, and that's the conversation that you want to have. The "what they are" conversation, on the other hand, takes things one step further and uses what they did and what they said to draw conclusions about what kind of person they are. This is also known as the "I think you are a racist" conversation. This is the conversation you don't want to have, because that conversation takes us away from the facts of what they did and the speculation about their motives and intentions, and those are things you can only guess at, you can't ever prove, and that makes it way too easy for them to derail your whole argument. And that is the part that's crucial to understand. When you say, "I think he's a racist," that's not a bad move because you might be wrong. That's a bad move because you might be right. Because if that dude really is racist, you want to make sure you hold him accountable and don't let him off easy. And even though intuitively it feels like the hardest way to hit him is just run up on him and say, "I think your ass is racist," when you handle it that way, you're actually letting him off easy, because you're setting up a conversation that's way too simple for him to derail and duck out of. Just think about how this plays out every time a politician or a celebrity gets caught out there. It always starts out as a "what they did" conversation, but as soon as the celebrity and their defenders get on camera, they start doing judo flips and switching it into a "what they are" conversation. "I have known this person for years, and I know for a fact that they are not a racist, and how dare you claim to know what's inside their soul just because they made one little joke about watermelon tap dancing and going back to Africa." And then you try and explain that we don't need to see inside their soul to know that they shouldn't have said all that about the watermelon, and you try to focus on the facts of the situation, but by then it's too late, because the "what they are" conversation is a rhetorical Bermuda Triangle where everything drowns in a sea of empty posturing until somebody just blames it all on hip-hop and we forget the whole thing ever happened. Don't let this happen to you. When somebody picks my pocket, I'm not going to be chasing them down so I can figure out whether he feels like he's a thief deep down in his heart. I'm going to be chasing him down so I can get my wallet back. I don't care what he is, but I need to hold him accountable for what he did. And that's how we need to approach these conversations about race. Treat them like they took your wallet and focus on the part that matters, holding each person accountable for the impact of their words and actions. I don't care what you are. I care about what you did.
So next year, y'all have to have Jay Smooth out here, right? All right. So what he's talking about is a language of accountability, right? That there's consequences for the actions, and if we focus on the consequences of the actions, right, we're in much better shape to deal with an evolving form of racial conflict, right? So the threat right now is we've got changing norms that center intentions and marginalize consequences, right? Right? So if we're looking for a language of justice, we're looking for a language of accountability for those outcomes. And that language needs to identify new routes to inequality and for accountability. And that's part of the language I'm going to try and give you right now. All right, so we're good? Yes? Yeah. All right. All right, so the problem facing policing is exactly this problem that I've laid out, right? Declining prejudice, experience of racial inequality in policing, and how do we make sense and fix that? So what is that new language? I'm going to offer that part of it can be a language of identity traps. What the heck is that? All right, so identity traps are a frame, right, for contemporary bias that's rooted in human psychological universals that tend to end badly. And there are two types, fast traps and slow traps. For those of you who are psychologists, if this smells a little bit like Danny Kahneman, it's okay, he gave the stamp of approval. I stole liberally from that. So what the heck are fast identity traps? Anybody in here heard of implicit bias? Yep. Right? A couple folks, yes? Implicit bias is a smaller subset of fast traps. These are the things that are super fast, they're uncontrolled, they're hard to prevent. Not thinking, not monitoring tends to bring it out, right? Implicit bias goes underneath this, right? But I find that telling people what a definition is way less effective than showing people. So if you wouldn't mind coming with me and just answering a bunch of questions out loud, we're going to do it in unison. No one's going to get singled out. So if you can do it out loud, just the first answer that comes to mind when I ask a question. Is that going to work?
Yes.
All right. So for the folks who remember in the room, what kind of music did Peter, Paul, and Mary play?
Folk.
Folk, right? What kind of music did Peter, Paul, and Mary play? Folk. What's the wire in the center of a wheel? What comes out of the end of a cigarette? Smoke. Okay, comedian tells you this, makes you laugh.
Joke.
If you have no money, you are?
Bro.
What's the white part of an egg?
Yolk.
What's the white part of a yegg?
White.
What's the white part of an egg?
White.
Aha! Aha! I'll be here all week. Make sure to tip your wait staff. Try the veal. All right, so what you're supposed to take from this, though, is not that I'm a wizard who can control your minds, though that's totally true. It's that I'm a wizard who can control your behavior, because you said it out loud, right? And most of you said it out loud together in unison. Several of you said it a couple of times. I stuttered there in the middle. I didn't get my high score. My high score is 7. I'm trying to get to 10 before I retire this. And here's the other thing, right? Deep in my heart, I don't believe that deep in your heart that any of you are yokists. Okay? This doesn't reveal anything about your character, right? Nobody's feeling bad about this. In fact, many of you I see are taking notes, going to try and do this at your next cocktail party. Don't do it without the pictures. You're going to play yourself. I'm trying to help you out. but while you don't feel badly for having said yoke, right, and you shouldn't, we do when the automatic folk yoke association ends up being women and overly emotional. Or Latinos and an illegal person, whatever that is, or blacks and criminal. It feels like this reveals something about our character, even when the operations might be the same, right? Which is why I don't have you all screaming out, black people, at the end, because that would not be a fun talk, right? Way more fun to shout out yoke. That's what a fast trap is. That's what it does. It puts you in a situation, and it's important to get, it's the situation where you might act inconsistently with what you know to be true or good, inconsistently with your values. Now, here's the thing. Fast traps are cool. They're sexy. They're great lab and classroom experiments or examples, right? They're also epistemologically seductive and therefore kind of dangerous because fast traps aren't the only route to get there. There are also slow traps, okay? I want us to make sure we focus on slow traps at least a little bit. Slow traps, as the name might imply, they're conscious. Right? We know that they tend to be going on, right? They're negotiated over time. And they tend to be threats to the self-concept, right? Like masculinity threat, or for the psychologist in the room, like stereotype threat. And we're going to get to that in a little bit. Now, again, I can tell you what the definition is, but better to show you. And I had you guys make fun of yourselves a little bit, so I'll do this with me. I've actually never quite done this in the same kind of context. This will be fun for me. So imagine that you're going, the holiday season has passed for many of us. Imagine you're going shopping with your significant other, okay? And if you go shopping the way that I do, at some point in time, you end up on what I call the boyfriend bench with a bunch of bags, looking at people, because that's all you got to do is people watch, right? So you're watching people go by, watching, eyes are going anywhere. You happen to see someone of your preferred gender walk by, and you follow, because you got nothing better to do. And then you make eye contact with your significant other, who says, oh yeah, they're cute. Would you like it if I looked a little bit more like that? Now, the correct answer to this is always, now see, why are you walking away? And the reason that that is the appropriate response is because what you want to say is, I'm a good and loyal partner. But you know good and damn well that was not the question that you were asked. So you have to find a way to fit your answer inside of their question. And while you're doing that, you're watching yourself fumble and not say anything right, and you got to explain that too, right? And this is kind of how slow traps function. There are questions that are really difficult to answer that take up all our cognitive capacity, and we end up not performing particularly well. And again, this is funny if it's not happening to you, okay? But it's much less funny when the question is, I'm smart enough, right? I'm man enough, right? And we're going to see in a little bit that that is a very scary question for some folks. I'm not racist, right? Because how do you answer that? You say, no, I took my racism test. I got a 65. I passed, right? Like, it doesn't work that way. You're looking around, you say, some of my best friends, oh God, right? There's no credential that allows for you to say, I have an answer to this question easily for most people most of the time. And it's distracting. So let me walk you through a little bit of what this looks like, both in the research world and in the field. Right, there's a feature of much of the work that I do is I try and make it matter out in the world, or at least see where it matters in the world. So let's start with fast traps. This is some research I did with Jennifer Eberhardt some time ago. We looked at 425 death-eligible cases in the greatest city in the history of the world. I'm glad that nobody laughed at that. Usually that gets a laugh. I appreciate that. I'm from Philadelphia, in case that's not clear. Of those, 39 were white, 386 are black. That's its own research. We took a sample of it, 153 cases. A death-eligible case is a case where someone's been convicted and the death penalty is on the table. Okay? And of these, it's roughly proportional in terms of the racial breakdown. And all we were doing here is looking at the fast trap of blacks associated with apes. Blacks and monkeys together. If you don't recall what that looked like, I encourage you to look at the footage of the first time President Obama ran for office for president. You'll see all the things I'm talking about. The wonderful thing in Philadelphia is that there's one newspaper of record for the students in the room. A newspaper is a rectangular thing that gets your fingers really dirty. Okay? So we looked at the one newspaper of record in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and we just looked for ape-related images for all of the death-eligible cases. And then we plotted them pretty straightforwardly. Okay? Just controlling for articles, the number of articles, how many ape-related metaphors did we see for white defendants and black defendants? With white defendants are going to be the white bars, black defendants the gray bars. For white defendants, about 2. For black defendants, a little over 8. Right? They're using more ape-related language. Now, maybe that's a fast trap affecting the journalists, but it sure as heck is going to influence the people reading it. What about being sentenced to death, which are going to be the gray bars, or life, which will be the white bars over here? And here, we're going to control for the number of articles, socioeconomic status of the victim and of the attacker, mitigating and aggravating circumstances. The sociologist David Baldus did us a wonderful favor in terms of being able to create metrics for these. Sentenced to life, about 6. Sentenced to death, around 12. And here, for the scientist in the room, it's important both for me to say it and to make it explicit, this is not a causal story. The newspaper articles are not causing the death penalty. How do we know? The people who are in the juries here are not allowed to read the news. And for the only time in the history of my research, that's more interesting. Because whatever is getting picked up by the newspaper is also getting picked up by the juries. That's how fast traps can operate. All right, so that's important. That matters a bunch. But I want to focus more on slow traps. And I want to do that because fast traps are in the news a lot. People are talking about implicit bias. Everybody's saying we need to train officers on implicit bias. That's true. But we don't talk about slow traps. And without that, we're missing an important set of tools. Okay? Now, I used to have a long introduction to this section where I'm going to talk about manhood threat. Okay, masculinity threat. Because people didn't understand how police officers had their manhood threatened. Just didn't make sense how that would relate to race. And then we had the shooting of Mike Brown Jr., and I don't have to do that anymore. I just have to redo this portion of the deposition of Officer Wilson, who shot and killed Mike Brown Jr. In his deposition, he says that Mike Brown Jr. told him, he grabs my gun and says, "You are too much of a pussy to shoot me." Now, I'm not talking about whether or not the shooting was justified. I'm not talking about whether or not the shooting was necessary. I'm talking about whether or not the officer's manhood was at stake during that interaction. And if you look at the offense reports of many of these use of force encounters, it is more often the case than you might suspect. It is fairly common. Officer's manhood is at stake. Okay. So we did a study. We brought in 63 patrol officers, 57 of whom were male. It's its own study. Half of them were what we call high masculinity threat. The other half were low masculinity threat. And we had them encounter white, black, and Latino suspects in a use of deadly force training facility. For the nerds in the room, that's like the X-Men's danger room. Yeah? Okay, a couple nerds, you're showing me where you are. I appreciate that. Thank you. I got a fist pump. I appreciate that. For everybody else, it's basically a room that's low-grade virtual reality. It's a room like this, but one whole wall is a projection screen. And there's technology at the back of the room where the person who's putting them through the simulation is able to choose what happens next. They're used to the film responding to them. Also important, they have a 9mm pistol. It's been retrofitted with a laser pointer. It doesn't shoot bullets, but it does click. It has the same weight and same action as a 9mm pistol because it is one. And has a laser pointer so you can see if and when they shoot. Okay. So we've got high masculinity threat, low masculinity threat, or high macho, low macho officers interacting with black, white, and Latino subjects. Okay? And what we measured was just aggression. And we're not very clever with how we measured aggression. You're going to see what I mean pretty clearly. So before we do, before we show the results, though, what do I mean by masculinity threat? What is it? Right? It's a very complicated definition, so you might want to take notes. It's a couple of paragraphs. I'm going to walk you through it slowly. No, I'm not. It's just macho. It really just is. It's just macho. People that have the need to demonstrate that I'm a man all over the place. And if you think about it, you should not have a hard time figuring out who these people are in your life. Okay? If you can't think of any of those people in your life, you are that person. Okay? So it's just macho. Macho is easy to understand. We have an intuitive sense of it if you've been alive and conscious and paying attention to people. But why would macho predict racial disparity? Why would it predict bias? So we formulated the macho recognize macho hypothesis, okay? Which is this. If I got to demonstrate my manhood, am I seeking out a masculine target or a feminine target? People are whispering masculine. Absolutely, a masculine target, right? More masculine the better, so long as I can win. Right, so I'm not picking up on Shaq, but if Shaq got a baby brother that's coming up to hear on me, it's go time. Okay? As masculine as I can and still win. And there is a stereotype about black men that they are hyper-masculine, though I'm evidence to the contrary every day. That's mean to laugh at that. Right? So the deal is, if I want to show my manhood, I might sort, right? I might choose a black target over a white target because they're seen as more masculine. So officer choice has this ironic effect on context and the contestation of race. It creates an ecology of contested masculinity. But threats, they influence the sorting where officers go, but they also influence the values of where they are. Right? What gets valued? What gets rewarded? Right? In those neighborhoods, it's going to be high masculinity style policing and performance. So if you are not a macho person, let's say, for instance, you're a woman, tends to be relatively low on masculinity threat. Go figure. You end up performing like high masculinity people, like high threat people, in order to get good performance evaluations. It shapes culture and context. Okay? So how do we think about this? Situations that threaten identities are set up to create group-based disadvantage. It doesn't matter which identity is threatened, though the more vulnerable group is almost always disadvantaged by it. Right? And this is not bigotry, this is human psychology. Right? So what do we do in this case? We can randomize officer assignments. Right? Let me give you another example where I can actually talk about where it's done. Las Vegas. This is stuff that happened in Las Vegas that doesn't stay there, and I'm quite happy about it. So Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department called us up. They said, hey, we think we might have a problem on use of force, generally. Not racial, just use of force in general. Said, can you help us? Said, I think we might be able to. We've got a legal agreement that allows us to look at the data. The data will be secure. We give it to lawyers. Lawyers charge by the hour. Took a little while to get it done. So while we're waiting for the legal agreement to get done, they drove out to the desert in an unmarked car. I wore a little red carnation. They opened up the trunks. They gave us a bunch of data. We looked through it. This, by the way, is a real story. I love that this happened. and if you're interested in the Q&A, I can explain to you why we had to do that. But we went through it by hand. Right? We're looking at a foot pursuit. Use of force, foot pursuit. Use of force, foot pursuit. Use of force, bike pursuit. Nope. Knocked him off the bike. It became a foot pursuit. Foot pursuit, foot pursuit, foot pursuit. What the heck is going on in your foot pursuits? Hey, Las Vegas, what's your foot pursuit policy? They said, our what? Okay. So you need a foot pursuit policy. But let's think about how foot pursuits function. How do they work? It's not like what you've seen in the movies and on TV. So it doesn't end with the old black cop tackling somebody and saying, I'm getting too old for this. That's not how it ends, okay? It ends when the young person who is fleeing realizes that they are faster than the people chasing them, but they are not faster than radio. And they give up, usually on their knees with their hands up saying, don't hurt me, I'm surrendering, you can't hurt me, I'm surrendering. Recall that this is how the arrest of Freddie Gray ended. He ran a block and a half, had outrun the police, but could not outrun radio. Now the deal is, if you've ever been on a foot pursuit, right? And if you haven't, I encourage you, go for a ride along. Right? You'll get a chance to do this. It's good for the cardio. you will know that around every corner, that's terrifying. Because there could be somebody there whose job it is to end your life. And you're angry at the person who's making you run and be that terrified. So at the end of the foot pursuit, you are very likely to give them a shot in the kidneys as the price of making you run. I know, because I felt that way, and my politics on this stuff are to the left of Gandhi. So what can you do to fix this? What can you do in the face of foot pursuits? Right. What's the policy? How do foot pursuits end? Well, here's the new policy. New policy is, since most foot pursuits end in someone giving up, we just made a suggestion. Hey, how about you put a rule in? The first person who was running, who catches up to them, may not be the first person to put their hands on them, unless they're an immediate threat to somebody. First on scene, can't be first hands on. Give that a shot. And this is what happened. Right? So we did the intervention at the end of 2011, beginning of 2012. We see basically a 23% reduction in total use of force. By the way, that's accompanied by an 11% reduction in officer-related injury over the year, and it stays lowered. Now, I didn't have to mention anything about race here, and they didn't mention anything about race to me. But in Las Vegas, you're not chasing white people between alleys. You're chasing white people in golf carts and while on the casino floors, right? These chases are happening in mostly black and brown neighborhoods. So not only are you reducing use of force generally, which who the heck thinks that's a bad idea, you're doing it disproportionately for black and brown neighborhoods. That's how you attack traps. That's how you create these greater toolkits to deal with justice. All right. So as I'm wrapping up, please, please, please don't leave here and say that Dr. Phil told you that bigotry was dead and over. It ain't. I have a whole slide that says that right there, and I put it on a slide, so it means it must be science, right? Bigotry is not dead. It has evolved. It's still a necessary thing to be able to engage. But we need a broader toolkit to deal with how race is actually lived. Okay? So the next steps in the federal space is, I've said, there's no federal data on police behavior whatsoever. There was just announced an FBI registry for use of force. We're very excited about that. We don't know what's going to happen with it under the new administration. So we'll see. And even so, even if it keeps going, it's voluntary. Okay? But we have had at least the backing of the federal government and the major police agencies for the National Justice Database, which is still the largest attempt to collect these data. And I'm hoping over the course of the next month, we're going to have a big announcement on how we're going to be able to make this more useful to law enforcement who wants to know how to do better. And let me say, in case it's not clear from the website or whatever background you guys have in this, most major city law enforcement genuinely wants to do better. It may not sound like it on television. The sound bites may sound terrible, but they genuinely want to do better. And the way I know is I'm a black guy from West Philadelphia whose job it is to call things racist, and they call me on the phone nonstop asking for help. They don't want a stamp of approval because we don't give them. They genuinely want to do better. And in addition, we have a national initiative for promoting community justice and trust in justice. It's called this, by the way, because DOJ is great at naming things. And you can laugh at that because that is not true. But the National Initiative is basically a bunch of money brought into six police departments to help them do the things we know work. And that will continue into the next administration. And the goal is we can translate science into practice, and then we can replicate that. If there's things we know that reduce use of force generally across the board, it's going to help us. But we have to have a broader language other than just it's about bigotry. Because otherwise what you're doing is a whole bunch of trainings on why it's bad to be a bigot. And I can tell you, anybody who's ever been through a diversity training that said that you were a bigot, that is not a fun thing to go through. Right? It does not drive your behavior afterwards, except it makes you not want to go to those same trainings again. Right? All right. So if I give you some take homes, hopefully you'll take them home. I want you to know that inequality is often not the product of intent, but that we still need a morally compelling language to talk about it. My hope is that traps can help with that, right? Because what that does, what traps do, they foreground the contexts over the individuals, the situations over character, and they allow for multiple routes to discrimination, a language for broader accountability. So you could be someone who habitually falls into traps, but also employers set traps for their employees, right? And I use this example a lot when I talk about this. Anybody ever been in a long-term relationship? But it ever happened? It's okay. Put your hands up even if you haven't. It's okay. It's fine. Right? You ever gotten that call? Honey, when you get home, we need to talk. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a trap. Because we never need to go home to talk about all the things that they're sorry about. We need to go home and talk about, yeah, I did something that needs fixing. Right? And here's the reason why I bring this up. Right? I bring this up. Some people are feeling that right now. They had that call today. I bring this up because when I talk about it, no one thinks I'm paranoid, right? Well, you might. Do you? Okay. No one thinks I'm paranoid because you understand the experience. It's the situation, right? Why don't we treat situations around race the same way? In a situation where adrenaline's up, time is short, we're going to be relying on these automatic associations. Let's avoid putting people in those situations. We can do that with this broader language of accountability. That's the point. That's the goal. And it turns out that doing research may help in and of itself. Let me end with that. I've talked to you about all this research that we do in police departments. Here is the most important thing we've ever done in any police department anywhere in the world. We work with 14 foreign governments and over 200 police departments across the nation. Most important thing we've ever done is show up. Because when we walk in the door, we're not, "Hi, I'm the federal government, I'm here to help." No, we're the nerds, and we're here to do the nerd things for you. And what that does, it brings traditional adversaries to the table who cannot trust themselves, but they can trust the process. And it gives license to people who want to be doing anything at all, the ability to start doing it. Right? So as we're facing a brand new world that has a lot of people very unsure about what's coming next, sometimes the first and most important thing to do is just to show up. And the next thing to do is to try and struggle for some language that can make sense of it at all. Because making sense of it can be a weapon against the insanity that threatens you in a world that doesn't make sense. So with that, let me stop and open up for questions. I hope I've made a little bit of sense tonight. These are people who are much smarter than me that make the research happen. Thank you very much for staying and listening. So can everybody hear? The question was, why is Chicago so dangerous? That's a great question. And I'm going to start with, social scientists usually start with answering questions with, "it depends." And I'm going to do one worse than that, which is I'm going to start with, "I don't know." But that's the truth. What I do know is that Chicago, about a year and a half, but I guess now closer to 2 years ago, had a 60% decline in violent crime year to date. And the year before, it had a 40% decline in violent crime. And the reasons for that, as best we can tell, and causality is hard over this because they were doing a bunch of things together, is because the superintendent at the time, Gary McCarthy, had engaged all of the scientists, and when I say all, I mean every single one of us, to do the trust building and the procedural justice and the implicit bias reduction work that everybody thought could be done. And then there was a reverse of course, not by Gary McCarthy, but by the city. And that reverse of course tracks with public opinion polling that we've been doing in the most dangerous neighborhoods, qualitative data, so we're doing interviews in the most dangerous neighborhoods, that say something changed in the police and we cannot trust them. Part of that were stories that came out that there were sites where they took people and literally tortured them, sites where they locked them up, and they didn't give them, I mean, forget about habeas corpus, they gave them no voice at all. They locked them up for weeks and sometimes months without letting them go, with barely the basics of survival. When that comes out into a community, as the work of Matt Desmond and Andy Papachristo shows, it did in Milwaukee, when it's shown that police are behaving in an illegitimate way, it makes it really difficult for anybody to decide to call the police. Because if I call the police because I'm afraid for my life, and calling the police makes me more afraid for my life, I'm less likely to do it. And if I'm a criminal, that emboldens me to take over that space. So I don't know, but I do know that the crisis of legitimacy of the Chicago Police Department is not helping the situation. And that's my best guess as to where we're going to find some kinds of answers. I hope that's a little bit satisfying to you.
This gentleman here.
Thanks for your talk. It was really interesting. I've got one question about your experiment. You've split up the results into low masculinity threat and high masculinity threat? How do you determine those distinctions?
I love that question. Thank you so very much. So we do have surveys that will allow for that to happen, that where it's the male role norm scale, the male gender role threat scale. But don't use the surveys if you're trying to replicate this work. Instead, use the Denny's menu. What do I mean by that? Go to Denny's or IHOP. You'll see they got the kids menu and it's every menu. And there's a little section on it that's got a word search, right? Where you're supposed to find like all the capitals or all the water sports or whatever. So we said, fine, whatever words you want. We're not going to give you what words are in there. Whatever words you want, you got 2 minutes to do it. And we had regular word search words in there. But we also had words like wuss and pansy and fairy. And so the people who found the masculinity threat words in the first 2 minutes, The concept was accessible. They found him faster. And so we used that as a proxy. And that was the strongest predictor of high macho versus low macho. Being a psychologist can be pretty cool.
Okay. Thank you. We have a question right here. And then I'll go here, here, and then here.
Thank you. I really appreciate you holding this talk. I have two questions which are a bit related. And the first one is, who is this language intended for? And how do you deal with people getting frustrated with language being added on as it goes along, with, especially with people that are new to the topic?
Mm-hmm. Those are fantastic questions, and thank you for asking them. And I don't just mean that as a chance to give myself some time to think of an answer. So who is the language intended for is a fantastic question. That's the first time I've gotten that talking about this stuff. So gold star for you. It's intended for people who are going to talk about it, which I'm hoping is going to be America at least. This is not intended as activist language only. Right? Because the intention-centered language and the character-centered language that we have about prejudice and discrimination, that was not intended for just one group. There's a wonderful book by Daryl Michael Scott called Contempt and Pity, where he talks about this, the language of damage, that we've damaged black people, and therefore on the political left, that means we should help them. On the political right, it means, look at how damaged they are. We can't possibly help them. They're beyond reproach. Okay? But it's that same language. My hope is that we're able to use the language of situations and context, the language of identity traps, as a language of justice that then pervades. Right? So if you're on the political left of the spectrum, you mostly likely don't call yourself a liberal anymore. What do you call yourself?
Progressive,
right? Yeah, progressive didn't come up with that, though. Right? So there is language that we all share to talk about shared issues, and sometimes you win in the language game, and sometimes you lose. My goal is that this is put onto the battlefield and that it wins. Okay? And then how to deal with people who are frustrated with more language when they're new to it, I feel you. Right? If it's not you, I feel whoever's feeling that. I was at the cut when I'm young and I had hair, it wasn't that long ago, but feels like a long time. When I was all the new language. No, you can't do that. I'm not African American because that centers the African experience and this is an American experience. I'm black. Black is not bad. You need to learn that and don't call me Negro and color's not so good. And all that. I was there. I was ready to fight the language stuff. And then someone put cis and trans with an asterisk next to it. I said, the f is that? Right? I didn't have it growing up. What are you talking about? Like, that's my whole identity. You didn't know. And actually, gender's not a binary. And what you need to be doing, I was like, come on now. I'm old. I'm like 30. That's too much. So it feels like a lot when folks are coming at you like your character is suspect because your language is deficient for their experience. Okay? But if what you want to do is make the context better, if you want to heal the space, then what I say is that's your work, right? I'm a language creator, right? I got a lot of work to do in the spaces that are new to me. I walk into American Indian spaces, to tribal lands, I talk to folks, and I'm like, oh, I'm the people that I hate. I don't know anything about, I just know that terrible things were done, and I am partly responsible. Can I help? Or am I a jerk? And both of those have to be okay, because I'm committed. I know enough about the history that I'm committed to doing better. The work is sometimes taking your licks on the way to learning the language. And for those folks who have the language, the work is sometimes finding a way to be human with the people who are in a different stage in their process. Remember that this is a human process. Right? It's not like these are new things. It's not like up until 1800, everybody was cool and power wasn't a thing and exploitation wasn't a thing. These are the human experience problems. Right? And if you're not human in the ways that you transact about them, then you are making them worse, even if you're from a position of moral superiority.
Is there something different when it's a white officer versus a black officer on an aggressive black suspect?
That's a great question. So I'm going to answer that question and another question that I know other people are thinking. But to the first question, does it matter if the officer is black or white? It does, in the sense that they are black or white, and in no other way. Their behavior is the same. Absolutely the same. And that's distressing, because we were hoping that having different sets of experiences might allow for them to do different things. But this is not an easy story. That's part of the reason why we need a more developed language for it. right? Because we have black officers who come in who are, unsurprisingly, low on racism, measured a whole bunch of different ways. Low on anti-white bias and prejudice, low on anti-black bias and prejudice. And they behave the same way if they're high in masculinity threat, or if they're highly concerned with being seen as racist themselves, being seen as sellouts or Uncle Toms. So this is, it tells the story that context is deep, right? And that being an officer is that deep kind of context, because your life can depend on how you respond to it, right? And then the question that you didn't ask that I think other people are thinking about, you talked a lot about masculinity threat. Are there no police women? What the heck is up with the women, right? And again, I have to say, we did test women on masculinity threat. They came out lower than men. Totally shocking. And it turns out that women are lower on masculinity threat for a number of different reasons. Not only because they're not concerned about their own manhood, not having much in most cases, but also because when it comes to de-escalating threatening men, that's kind of the experience of women throughout their lives. They got a lot of practice. Men, when we encounter other threatening men, we fight. Women say, stop that. And it works. So women are better at de-escalating in the aggregate than are men. Makes them often better police officers, with one caveat, and I don't know why it happens at exactly this height, okay? They got to be above 5'2". And the reason is the 5'2" seems to be the magical number, and I don't know exactly why that's the number, but below 5'2", again, go on a ride-along with a woman officer at some point. Every woman officer I know who's worked patrol ever will show up at some point to a noise disturbance, to a domestic abuse, to something. Someone will open the door and say, "Aw, who ordered the stripper?" Yeah. So your legitimacy as an officer is challenged straight out of the gate. And if you're short and you're patrolling by yourself, you have to demonstrate that you have the power of coercive force. And so they end up escalating at a much faster pace. They literally fill out the masculinity threat form as if they're a highly masculine man or a highly threatened man. So there is a thing to stature in this, and some departments have started to take this research and call it authority threat for that reason. That's, again, not a question that you asked, but am I wrong that other people were thinking about it? Yeah, all right, so other people were thinking about it. I want to make sure we got to it today.
There we go. Thank you.
I want to ask about the organizational context, because I thought you very quickly mentioned that I want to ask about the organizational context. You said something about selection of assignments, and that the high masculinity threat people concentrate and select the most dangerous assignments in terms of crime. And I thought you said that even women, female officers, are then kind of modeling themselves on these people and also selecting those kinds of assignments. So is there a dynamic inside police departments whereby the high masculinity threat people kind of drive the culture in such a way that status and promotion are associated with doing the more dangerous things and putting yourself in more dangerous situations?
So that's exactly right in the districts that are majority high macho. And so what I was trying to show was that in those districts, it's not just the new patrol folks that are going in who tend to be higher macho folks. It's also the sergeants and the lieutenants and the captains. And that drives the culture. So if you have the misfortune of being low macho and getting assigned there, you better behave like you're high macho. Otherwise, there will be consequences for it. You won't get promoted. People won't have your back. You won't be well liked. You don't share the values. You don't fit in. So there's a cultural fit element of it as well as an identity element to it. And it's driven simply by majority, right? It doesn't have to be, yeah, so it's the majority of folks. If I got a precinct that's 80% high macho people, it's going to be really difficult to be a low macho person and be thought well of in that space. So that then drives higher macho behavior and higher macho behavior. Okay.
Our last question will be this woman right here. The microphone is coming behind you.
You get the best one. Come on.
No pressure.
Thank you. And thank you for the talk. It's been really interesting, and I really enjoy your presentation style. Okay, so you say you're focused on outcomes, and from my experience studying program evaluation, the best way to evaluate outcomes is to build in evaluative markers at the outset. So how would you respond to the assertion that policing is racist because at its inception, policing culture and as an institution is inscribed with patrolling and punishing formerly enslaved African black people?
So it's important to know that history. And so many police officers and police departments don't. They don't live that history. They don't own it in communities. But I think that an origin story is insufficient to characterize an organization at present, right? So you'll hear a lot of people say, all right, but my family didn't own, or like, yeah, but that was then and not. I think a more compelling argument for it is that policing has always been about controlling the movements of people who were vulnerable at the behest of people who were not vulnerable. And that's a difficult thing to manage. I was saying earlier today, in fact, I think at lunch, that a fully realized democracy, the way you can know about it, is that it has a functional and democratic police organization. And by that, what I mean is policing in the way it frequently functions now, the way it's functioned in this country's history and functions most of the globe, the job is to protect one class of citizens against another, as opposed to protecting all citizens against chaos and violence. And when you're able to do that latter part, which is way harder than it sounds, then you have a fully realized democracy in the sense of the coercive elements of the state being used for the good of all people. It's incredibly difficult to do it, given America's history, particularly given the history of policing and that unrecognized portions of it. There are continued vestiges of that. They're not vestiges. There are continued legacies of that in contemporary policing all over the country, even in places where the police department was formed officially codified after emancipation. But I think simply making reference to the history is an unconvincing argument to too many people. You got to make reference to the history, and you got to draw that thread all the way through to the present moment. It can be drawn. It should be drawn. and I think that setting up the goal as being able to break from that legacy is a noble thing to do. So I guess that would be how I would respond.
Thank you once again for coming. Thank you again, Dr. Goff. Have a good evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.